Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
Welcome to Living the Solution with Dr. Elena George. Today we have an important conversation. I think the last 2.5-3 years have been very stressful for everybody. We've had changes in our healthcare system, access to healthcare, businesses have closed. I'm a small business owner myself, so I've been on the front line of the changes and trying to stay one step ahead and roll with the changes. And we have a lot of economic upheaval. And I wanted to have someone to come on to just give us a perspective, because this is, I think, unique. I don't remember ever having going through this, where businesses have been shut down and really the country was pretty much closed for months on end. And what does that mean for our future? What have we gone through? If you're in the midst of it, I think you're just living it, but you don't have a bigger view. And I want to make sure people have a perspective, because we have to navigate this in order to get back some kind of normalcy. So we're going to speak with Dr. Sutter. He's the Charles G. Koch Professor of Economics with the Manuel H. Johnson Center for Political Economy at Troy University. He's a PhD graduate from George Mason University. His research has examined the societal impacts of extreme weather, the economics of the news media and media bias, as well as the markets and economic research, environmental regulation, and constitutional economics. He's published over 100 articles in scholarly journals in economics, atmospheric sciences, civil engineering, and political science, and written or edited 4 books. He writes a weekly column on economics and public policy for yellowhammer.com and Alabama Today, and monthly column on Alabama economics and policy for 1819 News. He's the host of Econoversations on Troy University's Trojan Vision television channel, a show examining economic and policy questions. He's also a policy advisor for the Heartland Institute. So Dr. Sutter, I want to thank you so much for joining me, because I think our conversation is one that maybe, as you know, people don't know, but I have a feeling that knowledge is power. And if people can figure out why they're feeling some kind of way and know the historical background of what's going on and how we can navigate it, I think it would be very helpful. So thank you for joining me.
Well, I'm very glad to have on the show, to be on the show. I'm happy to here to discuss this important topic with you.
Thank you. I want to go into the article that you wrote, Economic Freedom and the Pandemic. And first of all, am I really out there by thinking that this was really never happened in the history of our country in terms of the economic outfall?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, when you go back about 100 years to the Spanish flu, there were a few places, like a few cities that, you know, had some kind of a shutdown for a very brief period of time, like when that virus was raging very heavily in their communities. But, you know, the widespread shutdown of businesses, schools and everything for months on end was completely unprecedented.
Now, before the shutdown, the economy was pretty much rolling along. It seemed like even the people who were on the fringe of society were benefiting from economic choice and freedom. And I want to go to one of the tenets of your article, economic freedom. What does that mean exactly?
Well, economic freedom really ultimately means the freedom to buy and sell the goods that you'd want to buy, and then also the freedom to sell your labor or to start a business and to trade with each other. And those economic transactions should be voluntary. And as we have to deal with each other, voluntarily and by convincing each other to want to trade with each other, to buy what we're selling or to sell us what we would like to buy. And for about 30 years, the Fraser Institute in Canada has been trying to actually measure this, because we've known for decades, for hundreds of years, going back to the great economist Adam Smith, that like economic freedom was important. But one of the big innovations was to try to come up with a way to actually score this, to actually try to measure which countries are more or less free.
And when you talk about freedom, to me, it seems the antithesis of quote and planned economy. And that seems to be something that we're moving towards and other countries. Is a planned economy more of a government, a centralized type of system? Because you're talking about freedom. That means if you decide you want to hang out a shingle as a doctor, you just do it. And when it's centralized, exactly. That's being completely, it's that choice is being removed. Am I correct in thinking that?
Correct. Yes. Yeah. So what we're trying to measure with a measure of economic freedom is if there is a willing buyer and a willing seller, then that's all you need to make a deal. So if you want to hang out a shingle and somebody wants to come and patronize your business, then the two of you are the only ones who have to agree to this. To the extent that you have more people, especially government bureaucrats, who have to, in effect, give permission for such a trade to transaction to take place, then you're going to have less economic freedom. And if you want to think about the limiting case of very little economic freedom or no economic freedom would be a case of a planned economy, when you have the people people with the government actually trying to run or plan the entire economy. Because then the decisions about what's going to be bought or sold or what's going to be produced are being made by government bureaucrats, not by you or I or people out there saying, I want to buy this. And somebody says, yeah, I'd be willing to sell you that.
Mm-hmm. It seems like it takes away innovation, because if someone's telling you what your worth is, you know, arbitrarily, this particular business is, you know, it's like climate change, for example. You can't have something that's oil-based pretty much, and they're deciding the value of something, but it's not necessarily what people want to buy. Is that planned economy trying to coerce patients, I'm a doctor, or coerce patients, coerce buyers to change their habits, because it's not something that seems to be natural.
Yeah. And so if you're trying to, you know, to the extent that you go in and interfere with the idea of a willing buyer or a willing, you know, and a willing seller and say, and somebody else imposes their preferences saying, like, I don't want you to be able to buy that. I don't want you to be able to buy that gas powered automobile. Then that restricts economic freedom. And, you know, there's a one case with some types of pollution you could point to it and say, like, well, the issue comes down to one of property rights. And, you know, with certain types of pollution, you could argue that what's happening is, oh, people are polluting the water. So they're, in effect, using that water to help, you know, to dump chemicals into or dump waste into without treating it. And they're sort of like using that water maybe without permission. And so there are some types of cases of pollution where we'd argue, like, okay, you need to have some kind of, you know, some kind of extra decision making, some kind of extra voice for the people who say water, clean water is getting polluted, to be able to step in there, because otherwise that transaction with the willing buyer and the willing seller, well, that willing seller is ending up polluting something that they haven't actually like purchased or gotten the rights to use.
Well, I know we're going to take a break in a minute, but I want to start the conversation with that willing seller. When it's corporate based, do you find that there's a difference? You're talking about an individual who may have something that, or a small group or a small company. Does that still, can you still think about that in terms of corporate America? Because I'm thinking really of things like Michigan, where they had tainting of their water supply. And that was something that was more, it was a broader devastation. It wasn't individuals, but nothing really happened to the entity or the companies that were causing this. No one ever served any time. Nobody ever had to pay a price. So it seems like it's a double standard. It's really applied to the individual because they don't have a lot of power. But when it comes to something bigger, it just seems to be they get a pass. And I know I'm going to have to take a break and have you answer that when we come back on the other side. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Sutter, and I'm sorry to have cut you off, but I wanted to give you a chance to think about that, because it seems there's, you know, throughout our system, it's a double standard of some people are more equal than others, corporations specifically. So from that question, am I being sensitive in thinking that when it comes to a big, huge, monolithic entity, they can do whatever they want, but the individual seems to pay the price more than anybody?
Well, I just think that's certainly partially true, and it deals and it addresses an element of economic freedom or a violation of economic freedom. And that is, the rules are supposed to apply to everybody. But one limitation to that is that If you are rich, or especially if you're a large corporation, you might be able to lobby politicians and in effect get the rules, change the rules from what they're supposed to be, or get yourself an exemption from a rule that, that applies to everybody else. Our economic freedom measure talks about this in terms of the rule of law. And the rule of law is, one way to think about it is everybody's supposed to be equal before the law. And, it's that rule of law and then like enforcing and protecting people's property rights that really helps ensure that all of these transactions are going to be voluntary. And, nobody's supposed to be able to get around that. So I think, what you're voicing there is the fear that the powerful in our country, and is even far worse across the country, across the world, because we do a lot better job of approximating this in the United States than in some countries. But the powerful, especially large corporations or maybe the wealthy, would be able to, in effect, buy unequal justice, buy their way out of having to play by the same rules as everybody else. And that's a real problem. And we would try to measure that in our measure of economic freedom. And that is a definite issue. And, that would certainly be a problem. One of the bigger problems, I think, that actually turns out to be the case is that it's not necessarily the larger corporations get exempted from the rules, but the fact is big companies have a lot easier time trying to deal with some of the rules than small businesses. When we look at when it comes to regulations, one of the biggest things is complying with those regulations. And large companies, are big and they can afford to hire whole staffs of lawyers and other experts to just negotiate. Leave aside the possibility they're also going to give some campaign contributions to bend those rules, but just to comply with them, they're able to hire lawyers and other people who can simply do nothing else but help them comply with the law. If you're running your own business, a small business, you've got to attempt to try to comply with many of these same rules, and you've got to try to do it yourself in addition to trying to actually run your business. And so that burden of compliance actually tends to be really, really high on small businesses. Sometimes they can't actually fully comply with the law, and that leads them to be vulnerable to be shut down simply for not being able to comply with rules that it's just very, very hard for them to comply with.
I totally agree with you. The cost is sometimes prohibitive. And, from the healthcare side of it, having to dot your I, cross your T, they change every year. You actually have to hire somebody to go through everything from your HR, your handbook to OSHA. I mean, it's really amazing. I mean, the hospitals and the surgery centers also deal with that. I can imagine you take that burden and you apply it across the different work forces across the country. It's amazing. I wonder who makes these rules. I mean, it's a kind of a esoteric question, but it doesn't seem the people who are actually on the front line of any business making these rules. How do they come up with them? Do they look at this from a global standpoint, or is this something that it seems sometimes arbitrary?
For the regulations that we come from, that's a part of this quasi-permanent regulatory state, administrative state that different people talk about. I think President Trump has referred to the swamp, and some other people refer to it as a deep state. And that's a part of it. It does come from legislation. Congress will pass a law, but a lot of times Congress passes a law saying, the Health and Human Services will write all these regulations to enforce the Affordable Care Act or the new prescription drug rules for trying to lower the cost of prescription drugs. So Congress sometimes passes a law saying, authorizing the writing of regulations, but then the regulations are formulated by these regulatory agencies. A bunch of experts working for these agencies. Well, of course, we also know that many of them go back and forth to the big companies that they're regulating. So it's sort of a revolving door, and there's sort of like this permanent government. And it's not clear who they're really accountable to. It's difficult for Congress to necessarily exercise a lot of control over them. And these, they formulate these rules. They do have to follow a lot of administrative process in terms of formulating rule and publishing it and letting the public comment on it. But many times, even though they're supposed to respond to public comments, you know, it seems like it's a done deal ahead of time that they've already decided what they're going to do. Mm-hmm. And so it sort of comes out of this like intersection of these, especially these like permanent bureaucracies and the bureaucrats. But again, like with the revolving door, many times it's the big companies that are being regulated, and people who are either have worked for them in the past or plan to try to work for them again in the future are writing a lot of these rules. A lot of times, you know, with like big companies having the ability to have their lobbyists or their experts weigh in and help shape a rule that the average person doesn't get any voice on.
It seems like it's conflict of interest just riddled through the system. And when you think about the pandemic, that's, you know, from the economic freedom side, I remember them pronouncing what an essential business was. And the essential businesses were interesting. You know, in Georgia, for example, strip clubs were essential. Liquor stores throughout the country were essential. And the big box stores and the online market was open. But everybody else who had a brick and mortar, not everybody, but most people had a brick and mortar had to shut down. How do you think that came to pass, that they could just pronounce who was essential?
Yeah, and that was in small scale or one aspect, this idea of central planning. You know, the whole idea that there were some people maybe with the state public health department or maybe in consultation with some people from the Commerce Department or some people in the governor's office are going to get together and say, oh, what businesses are essential and we need to have stay open and which ones can be closed. And, you know, obviously, if you own a business, like your business is essential to you. And
exactly.
You know, if you work for a business, to say that business can be closed, I mean, that's sort of also saying like, well, you can be laid off. You don't need your job, but you need that job to help pay the bills and let you afford to live. And so, you had this, a part of it is just a whole idea of central planning and the important, the relevant thing being that the people who think that they know enough to be able to make all of these decisions, they really don't know nearly as much as they need to be able to make these decisions. And so, you saw some really arbitrary decisions about like what was essential and what wasn't. I know in Pennsylvania they issued the decrees about who was essential, and then they immediately were rolling them back as like people were saying like, no, it's really important. We have to keep these other businesses open, and so it showed that they didn't really know enough. You know, when they came down with these prescriptions about what was essential and what wasn't, and I really wonder to what extent some of the supply chain difficulties we're having now, that these bottlenecks are from businesses that somebody didn't think was all that essential, that we could, non-essential and could be closed. And they stayed closed for a few months and they weren't producing what they needed. And then like it turned out they were producing something pretty important that you can't make a car or a computer or a phone without now.
Exactly. And looking at just referring back to the Canada Fraser Institute and the measurements, I mean, there's like five different categories. If you can just go over that so people can get a bigger picture of what constitutes economic freedom, what's measurements.
Sure. There are five areas. The first one is referred to the size of government. So that's taxes and the amount of spending. The second one would be the legal system and property rights. So that deals with this idea of the rule of law and do you have effective control over the stuff that you own, including like your business. The third area refers to money. It has to deal with money. And so things like money supply growth and the rate of inflation would be in there, because you need to have a sound currency to be able to carry out transactions and exercise your economic freedom. The fourth area involves things with the international trade, and to what extent both the trading and then movement of people across countries, and then also international finance. So areas with regard to the global economy. And then the fifth area deals with various kinds of regulation, whether it be, labor regulation, like from OSHA, or healthcare regulation, or environmental regulation. Those forms of regulation, I think, often a big part of it is to look at labor markets and how free labor markets are.
And when you talk about you know, in terms of the labor portion of the market, the two mindsets to me is a capitalistic view and a socialist view. Can you, I mean, I have a feeling what I, how they both manifest, but is the socialist view more aligned with the central planning, with the centralized approach where it's all driven from one entity and then it just, you know, goes out and everybody's has a value put on them, or their services have a value put on them? Is that one way to think about how socialist policies are different from economic freedom?
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it, because, you know, I think economists, we actually prefer, we don't really necessarily like the terms capitalism and socialism, because we, you know, what matters is what's the pattern of decision making. And so with markets and economic freedom, you have like decentralized decision making, and you have that willing buyer and willing seller. And if the two of them get together and they want to make a deal, they can make a deal, versus the idea of some kind of centralized control. And, the decisions being made by the government or you know, whether it be our elected officials or probably bureaucrats who are going to be making these decisions for us. And at least the biggest ones, you know, it doesn't mean they have to make every decision, but at least the biggest ones, the most important decisions might be being made by government officials centrally, and with commands going out to try to make people do what it is that the planners want them to do.
It doesn't seem like it's real time. I mean, I'm looking at this push towards green energy, for example. And my question has always been, and again, we're going to probably revisit this after the break, if they want to change our habits, could they not do this in a less disruptive way? Let it happen naturally. I mean, I guess they tried with giving you tax credits, et cetera, but it's still prohibitively expensive. And it still doesn't really accomplish what you want, which is to come off of oil or coal or some sort of energy that's not green, because it's all based off of those particular entities. So is there, from an economic standpoint, this movement towards green everything? First of all, my question is it really economically viable? And two, is there anything that we can do to make this, if it has to happen, slower? And I'll let you answer that question after the break, because we have to take our next one. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Sutter. And before the break, I was curious to find out what his thoughts were about this movement towards worldwide, really, green energy. It's disruptive. It's really just upending the economies of all countries. And if it has to happen, could it happen in a less abrupt way? Because it doesn't seem like they're really, you don't even have enough energy to supply what you need to in terms of the green energy. I'm thinking of Texas, for example, where their wind power went down because they didn't have it. And then they had blackouts and energy grid problems. From an economic standpoint, is that something, is it viable? Is it something that we should be moving towards? Because it seems to be everybody's on board with that from a government perspective.
Well, from the government perspective, it seems to be everybody, many, many people are on board with it. From an economic perspective, you know, it's one way to think of it is that fossil fuels have some very definite economic advantages, one of which is that they have, you know, and it depends on the type of fuel, but especially like oil, it has very high energy density. In other words, if you think of like the per pound of oil or whatever, how much energy is there that you can get out of that? Fossil fuels, many types of fossil fuels have some very high energy densities. And that creates advantages, right? Because, I mean, you know, for instance, it's hard to fly a plane if you're going to have too much in the way of weight from the fuel. You know, you won't have any capacity to have any passengers or any cargo if every pound that you can lift off the ground with that plane has to be used using fuel. So you need stuff, you know, you need sources of energy that have this like very good energy density. And then you also have to consider the cost, you know, like cheap energy is very important. And so cheap energy means that it costs us less time and effort to get the energy and then do something that we could do physically by ourselves. What we're doing is we're powering machines to do our work for us. And so you have to think about, like, what's the cost and what's the effort of involved in building the machine, and then also getting the fuel to power that machine. And so there are some very real advantages, economic advantages to fossil fuels. And various different economists and the Energy Information Agency and others have projected that those advantages for fossil fuels are not going away anytime soon. So for the foreseeable future, there is going to be, from an economic perspective, there'll be important roles for certainly oil and natural gas and possibly in some cases coal as well. So there's an economic argument to say we need to be continuing to use fossil fuels for some time.
Well, it seems like they're jumping. I mean, they're making pronouncements that we want to do 100% electric cars by 2030. And, you know, California's moving towards that without regard, really, or shutting down all sorts of natural pipelines. And I mean, they're kind of making fossil fuels more expensive based on scarcity. So whatever advantage that you just described, seems like we're scrapping that before we can make a natural jump to something else.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, from the standpoint of climate change, if you're concerned about climate change, I mean, to say that an electric car is going to produce less greenhouse gas emissions, well, that's actually a pretty complicated question to try to answer, because, you know, first off, it depends on how you're generating the electricity. If you're burning coal to generate the electricity to charge that car, then, you know, there are fossil fuel emissions there. Yeah, there's no emissions as you drive your car after you've charged it. But, you know, you have to ask the question of how the electricity is being generated. You also have to look at most of our manufacturing processes use fossil fuels, because you have to generate a lot of heat. You can't produce steel, you can't produce concrete, things like of that nature, without a lot of heat. And fossil fuels are really good for that, because they have, like I said, this high energy density, and they don't cost all that much to be able to mine enough to generate the heat. So, you know, you have to keep that in mind as well, that, you know, electric vehicles do not necessarily reduce the amount of carbon dioxide emissions or greenhouse gas emissions. You also have to look at all those minerals. There's all these rare earth minerals you have to mine. And the mining processes currently use fossil fuels. So, I mean, again, because you need a lot of energy to dig into the earth and be able to dig out and process these minerals. So it's just, in one level, it's a complete lie to say that somehow electric vehicles necessarily are going to have no carbon emissions or no greenhouse gas emissions. It's a complicated question.
I think you're absolutely right. And what also strikes me is what happens when you have to get rid of these things. Like, so, you know, after the battery dies, I understand that you have to put that back into the environment. And it's quite toxic. So one step you're saving the planet, and the other you're putting toxic waste back into it. Where does that go? What country's going to take that? I mean, there's all these questions that don't seem to be answered. And it's just full steam ahead without regard. So from the standpoint of our economy, is that making this, just curious, is it making this move now, this rush to endpoint, is that damaging? Is it making us less free economically?
I think it definitely would. I mean, I think it would, because ultimately, although it's, you know, some economists would say, like, oh, if you could have like carbon taxes or whatever, maybe there could be a little more freedom. But I think the bigger issue is that, you know, there would be people who would be willing to mine and process and sell people fossil fuels. And people are, and there's going to be a demand. There's going to be willing buyers for that, because they offer advantages relative to other things. They offer the best sources of cheap energy. And you know, so you'd have willing buyers and willing sellers, but, you know, then you have some possible, you know, future consequences of burning fossil fuels and increasing greenhouse gas emissions today, you know, that might impact the environment in the future. So you do have that offset of it, but you know, you'd have willing buyers and willing sellers, and you've got people like the state of California stepping in and saying, like, no, you can't have gas-powered cars, regardless of whether somebody's willing to, drill for oil and process it into gasoline, and somebody's willing to build you that car, and somebody's willing, and a buyer's willing to buy the car and the gasoline to drive it. They're saying, like, no, you can't, you're not allowed to do that. So, yeah, that is a definite reduction in economic freedom.
That makes me think for my next question, this universal basic income. You know, if the economy is kind of, you know, inflation, et cetera, it's limping along right now. Many people, I don't know, but have many people returned to their jobs? Are they still out there looking for jobs? Or they've stopped looking because they're getting money from the government?
Yeah, we are still down several million workers, and not because it's not the unemployment rate; it's the employment to population percentage, the number of people who are working relative to the population, and that dropped during COVID, and it hasn't recovered yet. And you know, economists have looked at that. I don't think we've got a full explanation for it. We've got a lot of explanations, so that might mean we don't have an explanation. It's also the case if you're talking about 2 or 3 million people who decided to stop working, who, you know, could have been or should have been working before the pandemic. It could be a lot of reasons, because you've got, you know, several million people, and they're all different and they have different reasons. So who knows what it is? I mean, I think, you know, it is probably government having some role to it. You know, and some of the other of it, you know, there could be perfectly good reasons people don't want to. Return to work. There might be parents who decided, you know, I don't like what my children are learning in schools. I want to homeschool them. I want to, you know, be more involved with their education. And so, you know, you might have a parent who's chosen not to go back to work so that they could homeschool their child. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. To sort of like force that person to go back to work isn't a good thing, because that would violate their economic freedom. But yeah, we are down some workers, and we don't know to what extent, you know, government policies are driving that.
Interesting. And what about the college age, the people who are graduating, coming out? You know, when I went through college, it was kind of a done deal. When you came out, you actually got employed, you had your whole future ahead of you. Is that still happening, in your opinion, for the people, for the college age kids, for Generation X? I don't know what generation we're up to now, but they don't seem to have the same future, and they don't believe they do either, compared to a couple of generations ago.
It does. I mean, it depends tremendously on what your major is, because, you know, right now the job market is extremely tight, you know, for people who want to work. Right? We have a record number of job openings relative to the unemployment rate. So there are a lot of businesses still looking to hire, and that's been the case for the last year or year and a half, or almost 2 years, since businesses started reopening after the pandemic. So, you know, it really does depend on your major. There are certainly many majors in which, you know, people are getting jobs, and, you know, having no problem getting jobs. All college majors are not created the same. And there are some that people are majoring in where they don't have, you know, very good job opportunities. And then many times they decide, like, okay, I can't get a job with my bachelor's degree, I'll go get a master's degree.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And from the college side of it, from the economic side of it, the cost, mm-hmm. is there any reason that you can think of that the cost just skyrocketed for, you know, for tertiary education? Right. Is it because of government policies, because they're getting money from that? What's up with that? It doesn't seem like it should be 10 or 15 times more than it was 15, 20 years ago.
Exactly. And this is one where I think we've got pretty good evidence that it is government policy, especially federal student aid and student loans, that are driving this. Because we can look at, you know, there are some things where you want to look carefully at the data. There are some degrees where you, you know, some places where you can borrow and have access to it, and others where you don't, and you see like a big difference in how much tuition or the cost of those programs can go up when you can use federal student aid, and in particular then student loans to borrow and fund something. So In one sense, you know, starting in 1965, we opened the federal spigot. They allowed colleges to get money from the federal government with relatively little oversight to try to prevent spending. And it's been a great ride for higher education. But, that's going to end at some point. And I think that, you know, the student loan forgiveness is going to be the first step to lead to some kind of effort to rein in what's allowed to be charged for costs.
Well, that's excellent. Well, I want to revisit that when we come back, because that's a huge economic bite, isn't it? So let's take our last break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living Solution. We're speaking with Dr. Sutter, and his article is Economic Freedom and the Pandemic. You have a podcast as well, am I correct? Or you write for other platforms?
Right. I write for Yellowhammer News and 1819 News. And we have this, it's available as both on YouTube as a show and then as a podcast called eConversations.
People need to go and listen to that, because the more knowledge you have, the better you're able to navigate. And before the break, we were talking about this student loan forgiveness. Initially, it was supposed to be very generous. It's been pared down, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it was announced at like $10,000. You know, many Elizabeth Warren and others were calling for $50,000. Some other people were even calling to forgive all student loans. So the version that the Biden administration decided to go forward with was not nearly as generous as what some people were calling for, but it was $10,000 and then up to another $10,000 for people who had Pell grants.
Now, before the break, you were telling us how government intervention is costing people more money in college tuition. How would, if they did, let's say they were able to do $50,000, how would that affect the economy? Is that something? I mean, it's money being paid back to the government, technically, I guess. Is it, people were saying it's just prohibitively expensive, it would put us in a bigger hole. Can you tease that out for us? Because I think people are, they don't really understand that. It just seems like it's kind of out there for them. But how do we all have to pay for that if that comes to pass?
Well, I mean, it's mainly going to be the biggest thing is to think of it as a shifting from the college graduates or people who have been to college and took out these loans, having to pay them back to the taxpayers, having to pay them back. And yeah, initially they'll almost surely lead to more government borrowing, so you won't have to pay for taxes now. But I mean, ultimately, the federal government is assuming that debt, that student loan debt that they're going to let people write off. There's been some debate by economists going back and forth as to whether or not that would help student loan forgiveness would help spur more spending by people. And one thing to keep in mind is that in terms of a stimulus for the economy. Well, first off, we don't need a stimulus right now. Is anything we've certainly seen? We've had way too much stimulus from the government going back to the last 2.5 years or so. That's a big part of the reason why inflation is so high. So we surely don't need a stimulus right now. But then the other thing is the amount of the stimulus. Well, you have to think about if somebody had loans that they were supposed to be paying back over 10 or 20 years, it's really just the amount that they were going to be paying every month. And so you get $10,000 of loan paid back. But I think if I remember the calculation, it worked out to something along the order of maybe $150 or $200 a month that would be of reduced payment. So it's the amount of the amount less that the borrowers who are getting this money forgiven will have extra to spend is relatively small.
I didn't think about it that way. So basically, the taxpayers are on the hook for very little positive money in someone's pocket that's supposedly getting a break. But, you know, the argument, is there an argument to be made for you voluntarily took on this debt? Why does everybody else have to pay it?
I think that's a very strong argument because, I mean, this is a loan. And, I mean, another thing to keep in mind is that there is this. It varies across the, depending on what your degree is, but there is a very pronounced college degree premium. And people with college degrees on over the course of their lifetime, on average, earn about $1 million more than people with only a high school degree. So college graduates are relatively affluent. Although loan forgiveness is being pushed by many progressive politicians, this is a case where the relatively affluent members in our society are going to be subsidized by the relatively poor people who didn't go to college and are earning less than what those college graduates are going to be making.
How interesting, since the progressive argument is about, you know, having a safety net for people who are at the lower end of our economic society, you know, lower end of the economic scale in society, and they're the ones who are going to be on the hook for this. It's kind of interesting how this works. It seems to be, it's never what they say. It's not the name of the bill. It's what the outcome is. It's just, is this a transfer of wealth? To me, Obamacare was a transfer of wealth. This economic bill is a transfer of wealth. And now this student loan forgiveness, because it's the people who are the working set in society that are going to be paying these taxes.
Yeah, the primary thing, you know, that government does is transfer wealth. I mean, government doesn't produce wealth itself. I mean, you can say that things like, you know, police and the military and the courts, by helping, you know, sustain economic freedom, especially like the property rights and the rule of law, can help support the production of wealth. But government itself doesn't produce the wealth. And at best, what it does is create an environment in which businesses and private individuals can create wealth. And so at some level, if we're not doing any things like, you know, providing courts and police and maybe the highways and interstate highways, the government at best is shuffling money around. And so it is to simply taking from one and giving to another person.
Kind of interesting, because the argument can be made that the bigger the government is, the more inequality you actually get, because they get to decide winners and losers.
Yeah, definitely. And there's certainly some ways in which I think you can say your government is making it inequality worse. You know, there are some policies that are really making inequality worse. And you know, one of the most pronounced ones are land use and zoning regulations that restrict the supply of housing, especially in like the most productive cities like New York and San Francisco, San Jose. And the people who own that real estate, it's worth a lot more. And there's a very big, you know, there's some research showing that a big chunk of the wealth that's accruing to the wealthiest people in our society is actually coming from these land use regulations. If we simply allow there to be more housing and more apartments built in some of these cities, you know, those real estate values would tumble a lot. And it's the wealthy Americans that are gaining so much from these restrictions on building.
And that makes me think also of COVID and when they had the rent moratorium. How did that affect people economically? I mean, I thought that they didn't have to pay that back, but that's not true, right? They actually have to pay the back rent that they got a holiday on. It didn't zero out, did it?
That detail I'm not sure of, so I'd have to defer to somebody else. I mean, I certainly know that there was a lot of waste going on there, and waste in that they tried to create new bureaucracies to hand out this money to help renters. And so it took like months to even start to get any kind of money out to the, the landlords who might have been not receiving their rent payments because of the rent eviction moratorium. And, you know, then also their tenants losing their jobs and, you know, being unable to pay the rent because they're not allowed to work. So then they don't have money to pay the rent. It had a lot of impacts, and there were impacts that we could probably have avoided by not shutting down so draconian, just so extensively in the first place.
I absolutely agree. You know, how is there any remedies that you can think of that we can, if we, you know, you and I ran things, how do we start to bring our economy back and to get people to have economic freedom, to open their own businesses again? Is there anything that we, that you could see that we could start that ball rolling?
I mean, we have to really address some of the regulatory issues. You know, I think like land use and zoning is a good place to start, simply because, you know, to allow more building in places where people could want to move. Because, I mean, again, there's some economic research showing that this is having a really significant impact on our GDP and also on also on inequality, because if you've lost your job in a place like Indiana and you might want to move to a city where there's more jobs and more economic opportunity, but housing is so expensive, it's a good reason not to try to move because you can't actually afford to work. And you know, we certainly see this with the tales of people having to drive like 2 hours or so, you know, to get to jobs in San Francisco. And even like, it's even to the point of like, professors at Stanford University can't live anywhere close to that university. It's not just like the staff, it's even worse, but like professors can't afford to live anywhere close to it because real estate prices are just so high.
It just seems every remedy that's being chosen is digging the hole deeper from what you're describing. It's very frustrating, but at least I'm sure my listeners and I both have a better understanding of things that, how we got into this mess. And from an individual standpoint, do you recommend that people, in order to take their own economic power back, consider becoming entrepreneurial, opening up their own and not depending on the government?
Yeah, I think self-reliance is critically important. And the good news is there are more different ways to make a living today than there's ever been before. Technology is opening things up. You know, we see some of that with remote work. But I mean, there are so many different ways. And I think it would be its own topic to get into. But man, you know, it's so sad that we have so many people with like this crisis of deaths of despair, people being unable to figure out how they, you know, how to make their life worth living when we have so many ways to make good and fun and interesting ways to make a living. It's, I think people need to be more entrepreneurial, whether that means starting a business or, you know, being their own like YouTuber or social media influencer. Mm-hmm. And there's so many different things you can, so many different ways you can make money and with jobs or doing things that aren't even going to seem too much like work.
I think you need to, if you can get up and love what you do, that is going to be that's soul fulfilling. And I'd love to leave this like you just did on a positive note. Time goes way too fast, but I wanted to thank you so much for joining me today. I enjoyed it.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. It's been a pleasure to do this.
And one last time, how can people read your column and follow your podcast?
The show is eConversations. You can search on either, it's on most places you get podcasts or also on YouTube. And then it's 1819 News or Yellowhammer News, Daniel Sutter.
Thank you, Dr. Sutter. You're amazing. Thank you for everything you do. Keep up the good work.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you. And thank you, everybody, for living in the solution.
Revolutionary Talk for Revolutionary Times. Liberty Talk FM.